Rodman and I hitchhiked to town, catching a ride with a farmer hauling the last of his summer corn to the station. "Country gentlemen," he advised, "the small white kernels are the best." From the station, we took a taxi to Rodman's place. Hank looked drained. Along the highway, I could have sworn that we passed a disheveled George Densmore looking deranged. When we reached Rodman's house, he insisted that I catch up on my sleep. Too weak to argue, I went straight off to bed and snoozed round the clock, waking early the next day. As I sat having my breakfast with one of Rodman's people, Billy Solomon, an ex-con who kept an eye on the estate, Rodman forlornly appeared. You could see what his night had been like. It was a few minutes before 9. Retiring to the porch, he stood facing Lily's house. Overnight, the weather had changed. I could smell in the air a hint of autumn. The sound of a lawnmower caught my attention. Mr. Swart, the gardener, was cutting the grass for the last time this season. He stopped and called to Rodman that he'd be draining the pool. "Once the leaves start to fall, there's hell to pay with the pipes." "Wait till this afternoon," Rodman told him. Smiling at me, he said, "I want to take one last swim before the party is over. Maybe you'll join me later." But I didn't. Instead, I had Billy Solomon pilot Hank's speedboat across the bay and drop me off at the Gillespie's dock. The green windsock was missing, and only an empty pole remained. I asked Billy to wait and hiked across the expanse of lawn, rehearsing what I planned to tell Lily. Not wishing to be turned away at the front door, I came through the veranda and found Lily, uncharacteristically, at play with her son. Leather valises stacked in a row suggested the Gillespies were about to leave on a trip. I stood undetected and watched as she read the patient Griselda to her son. When she'd finished, she told Tommy that although it was good for one to be patient, it was bad not to speak up when others were hurtful. On that note, I entered. "Henny," sputtered Lily, taken aback. "Here, how come? I mean, why? This is my son, Tommy. But of course, you met him the first time." As Lily called for the nurse, I shook hands with the little boy, who smiled politely. "I know what 2 and 2 are," said Tommy proudly. "I wish I did." "It's easy," he said as the nurse took his hand. "It's 4. "I'll bet your mama doesn't know that." Tommy laughed and skipped off. "What can I give you?" asked Lily. "An answer. 4. 2 and 2. "I'll get you a nice ginger." "No, thanks. All I want is talk." "Of course," she said, sitting down on the couch and inviting me to do likewise. "Is Hank all right?" "How should he be?" She lowered her eyes. "Unhappy." "Good guess. Did he send you?" "No." "Ah, then I can treat this as a social call," she said frivolously. "Lily, whatever others may think, I know you're no fool. Underneath that beautiful face is a chess player, well aware of every move she's making. I've watched you and admired you, so let's not pretend now." Her next gambit was flattery. "I see, a contest between equals. You win hands down. I'm just Huckleberry Finn in a dress. You're sophisticated. I'm not in your class." She laughed in a contemptuous way, but not at me. "That's why you jettisoned Hank, wasn't it? He wasn't in your class." "Don't. I adore the man. What am I to do? Give up my social position and lose my son to marry a bootlegger? You know very well the courts would give Tommy to Brad. Can you imagine him raising a child? You could take Tommy and join Hank in Europe. For how long? A lifetime? We're Americans. Home is here." "He'd go anywhere, Lily. Do anything to be with you." "Why not?" she replied with fire in her eyes. "My cost to him would be far less than his cost to me." I couldn't imagine what she meant. until she indicated that Rodman's friends were beneath her. To run off with him would have cost her the company of the smart set. She said that as it was, since they'd become lovers, friends of hers had been staying away. Morgan had even accused her of slumming, saying that with her beauty and wealth, she could have statesmen and princes. And yet, for love of Rodman, she'd been willing to throw caution to the wind and turn a blind eye to the ways of his wealth and the character of his colleagues. "Why did you get started?" I asked. "I didn't think it would end this way. No matter who you ran off with, the courts would still have called you an adulterer and given your son to Brad, despite the fact that he's one as well. You knew that from the start. I wanted a secret life. I longed to be loved. And now you have Brad." "No, I have Tommy." Frankly, I didn't believe her. The wish to be wanted, yes, but the baloney about her son, no. She was constantly handing the kid off to a nurse. "What's the point of this discussion?" asked Lily. "I can never go back to Hank. Surely you can see that." What I saw was Rodman taking the fall and Brad clearing up any confusion about which man to choose by giving her the diamond. "Did you read the morning papers? Was it the same Gertie Densmore from the garage?" Sarcasm was the only way I could think to reply. No, it was Miss Gertie Densmore from the Kudai family in Milwaukee. She always summers at auto garages." "You don't think I deliberately? You tell me." She lit a cigarette and changed the subject. "God, but Lexington was an innocent place. Hank and I would take a picnic basket to the swimming hole. We'd pack ham and turkey sandwiches, potato salad and coleslaw, too. We'd put the root beer and lemonade in the water to keep it cool. The first time I met him was at the Daughters of Lexington debutante ball. He and some other doughboys had wrangled a 24-hour pass from camp, and the mayor invited them to the party. I was dancing with Leopold Muskfit. He's a small-town journalist now. Hank cut in, which no polite Southern boy would ever do. Poor Leopold looked as if his whole world had collapsed. I knew she was shucking and jiving, so I took out the newspaper article that I'd stashed in my pocket and quoted the part about the police looking for the driver. That introduced some reality. I know that Mr. Rothstein owns property in Hewlett. Is Hank hiding out there? Hewlett was the location of A.R.'s old gambling place, which now stood unused. I played dumb. You must know, Henny. Why do you ask? Lily opened the veranda doors and looked out at the water. I don't deny it. I'm irresponsible, careless, and morally unreliable. But I didn't recognize Gertie Densmore in the road. I swear, I thought I'd killed a stranger. In some ways you did. You knew nothing about her. Do you? A little. Tell me. I want to know. She drew deeply on her cigarette and expelled the smoke slowly. I heard her husband talking about her. And? Without mentioning the diamond, I told her about how the woman had hoped to rise in the world and suggested that Gertie and Hank had something in common. What's that? Dreams. Lily said nothing. I wanted to tell her that she'd killed the illusions of both. Hank will be all right, she said. He can always call Fallon. I now had some idea of what had been discussed over the kitchen table. She and Brad would set sail. Hank would plead guilty. Fallon would defend him. And Lily and Brad would stay away long enough for the whole thing to blow over. I wanted to tap her on the shoulder and remind her that she, and not Rodman, was the hit-and-run driver. But I could see from her look that she wanted to believe Rodman had actually driven the car. And why not? She had undoubtedly led Brad and Morgan to think so. The police and the crowd at the garage would probably agree, and so too would George Densmore. "Who's that man at the end of the dock?" asked Lily. "His name's Billy Solomon. He brought me here in one of Hank's boats." He looks like an unsavory sort. Now that Hank's cover was blown and there was no reason any longer to pretend, I decided to spook her. He's an ex-con, out on parole. Fallon sprung him. Breaking arms and legs with a crowbar is his speciality. Would you like to meet him? Unfortunately, my little joke backfired. She coldly replied, Now you see why I had to leave Hank. To regain the upper hand, I spitefully said, There were witnesses, Lily. What if they say the driver was a woman? People are easily confused in the dark. You won't even be there to comfort him when they put him away. He always said he'd protect me. That's why he stood guard outside the house last night. She snuffed out the cigarette and lit another. I exploded. Do you realize how you're treating his love? Henny, someday you'll learn love's not an object. It's a mood. It's not a golden bowl. That was the last straw. I wasn't going to hear my friend's feelings dismissed as airy thinness. If the police arrest Hank, I said, I won't remain silent. She dropped her lit cigarette on the rug and stared at me in trembling terror. You, my friend. So was Hank. I squashed the butt underfoot. I see no reason to burn down the house. Name your price. The diamond Brad gave you. How did you? She began, but I cut her off. It was stolen and fenced. It's hot. Lily's head nearly wrenched free from her neck. Stolen? Her eyes were as big as eggs. Your high society husband, I said with delicious relish, buys from bums. It's yours. Here I must stop and confess that I'd come to Lily's house for two reasons. To learn why she'd abandoned Rodman, and to tell her that unless she admitted killing Gertie, I'd blow the whistle. But my big mouth had just compromised me. If I took a bribe from Lily, I was obliged to shut up. At that moment, I had to make a choice. Either leave the diamond behind and sing to the cops, or walk out with it and let my friend Rodman face the music alone. After Billy and I returned in the speedboat, I walked along the beach. Not long after 2, I heard a sound in the distance, as if it came from the sky, the sound of a snapped string, dying away, sad. Again I heard it, followed by a stillness broken only by the chirping of children playing at the edge of the sea. A terrible premonition made me shudder. I started for the house, walking, running, racing. Billy had also heard the sound, but thought it was just a farmer picking off hawks. We ran to the pool. In the grass, we discovered George Densmore, dead from a shot in the head. Rodman lay on a pneumatic mattress, slowly turning like a leaf in a lake, gently stirred by a breeze. A thin red string stretched from Hank to the end of the pool. He looked perfectly normal, except for the hole in his heart. Blinded by tears, I could hardly decipher the dial as I telephoned Lily's house. The housekeeper answered. I gave her my name, but she said the Gillespies couldn't be interrupted. So I mentioned the word murder. In the distance, I could hear Brad cursing. When Lily finally came to the phone, her voice was aloof and flat. Even when I shouted that Brad was a stinking hyena who had sent George Densmore to Rodman's house, having filled him full of lies, her tone never changed. Fear or shock or indifference had drained her voice of upper-class pretensions. With the thrilling pitch gone, she sounded ordinary. I told her that I would be arranging the funeral and begged her to come. I heard a choking sound, then nothing. Are you still there? No, came the reply. It was Brad. He hung up the phone. When I called AR to tell him what had happened, he volunteered to pay for all the expenses, but said he would never set foot in a cemetery. It's the vapors, he pleaded. They're bad for my stomach. Lags also refused to attend, as did all the other mugs and celebrities who had danced under Hank's silver moon and drunk his imported champagnes. The only people who joined me were his neighbor, Mr. Juniper, the butler, the gardener, Billy Solomon, and Hank's father. The service was simple. After Mr. Juniper spoke, the minister asked me to say a few words. A light rain was falling, but I hardly noticed. The beautiful mahogany coffin with its radiant brass fittings was mounted on boards and attached to a pulley and rope. I knew that my words would be the last before the gravediggers put the box in the ground, and knew that whatever I had to say was really for me. So I spoke of his migration from the Midwest, his soaring dreams, and his resemblance to a crippled bird beating its luminous wings in vain. I concluded with a prayer for reprieve, though I knew full well that Rodman was unsuited for this world. When pirates menaced the tropical seas, capturing sailing ships laden with silver and gold, the bloodthirsty buccaneers invariably made the captured crew walk the plank. Only one person was spared, the fiddler, because he was the music. Rodman was the music and should have been spared.